Thanks so much for joining. It's no small thing to watch an episode of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, so I really appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. My pleasure. Or, you know, my unique opportunity to talk Aaron Sorkin.
Well, yeah, I'm excited to get to that. Although, since we have you here, Will, I did think it might be fun off the top to talk a little bit about some of the stuff going on with your president at the moment. I mean, I had a chance to listen to the conversation you had with Dave and Josh on your show, but it seems like some new stuff has dropped that's kind of fun since, just in the last few hours. So perhaps we could start with that. I mean, God, where do we even begin with this?
Are you ready for Kamala?
I mean, look, I didn't fall out of a coconut tree, and I'm existing in the context of the things that, but the time in existing in the context of spaces is really where we're all at right now.
Amen.
And, you know, it's just come to crack open our heads like a coconut and pour out the juicy brain milk inside. So, yeah, I'm ready for Kamala. I'm ready for, I'm just ready for news to finally be happening.
It does feel like, yeah, this is like the most I've felt that like posts matter since 2020, to put it very stupidly. It feels like consequential things are happening again in politics at like the rate that they were very briefly for like a few months in, I don't know, maybe 2016 and again in 2020. I mean, just within the last 10 minutes, this is from Politico. The Biden campaign sends an all-staff memo seeking to calm internal fears. Apparently, they are still circulating these tracking polls that show them losing, but as evidence that they're actually doing fine. They also apparently, like this guy, Jeff Zients, who may be the campaign manager, he just like minutes ago held an all-staff call in which basically the line is like, don't worry, there's going to be a lot of chatter, just tune it out. At the same time, you know, there was a story like in the last half hour from the New York Times that Biden is like has spoken to some confidant about the possibility of suspending his campaign. So I don't know. I've gone back and forth on this since the debate on Thursday, like whether it's a real possibility that he might drop out. And the stories from the last few days that have made him seem like this, he's just like this lonely Nixonian figure surrounded by a palace guard of, you know, his family, Hunter, is now attending White House meetings, his grandchildren. But like, what's your sense of things at this moment, Will? Like, do you think there is a chance that he's going to drop out?
I mean, I've been wondering since 2020 how they were going to keep this farce going. And like, you know, as his senility has progressed, it's becoming, you know, almost impossible. I mean, after the debate the other week, I was like, this is insane. This is truly unprecedented. This guy is on a global stage, like incapable of coherent speech or thought. And I was just like, after that debate, like he's getting slaughtered in the polls. I mean, like it confirmed every negative that the public had about Biden. And so like, I don't know, like I think it'd be impossible for them to keep going with this and to have him continue to run for president. But if there's one institution that's capable of doing that, it's the Democratic Party. So they would be insane to keep this going. They would be insane not to just put in Kamala at the very least, let alone have some sort of open convention. But like, I think it is equally as likely that they just say, forget about the polls, you know, like I said, that Nixonian mindset of like, everyone always doubted me, you know, but we won and we're going to prove them wrong again. I could totally see them just continuing to go with Biden. And even though that seems to me unthinkable, every time you're faced with like, is the Democratic Party a political party that cares about its voters or even its like continued power as a political party, you assume that like, yes, there must be on some level some muscle memory for self-preservation. But that's not the case. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you can't underestimate their, I don't know, like their obstinance and that they're just like lack of just how little they care about any of this shit that they say that is the reason that we all have to vote for them.
I did wonder after seeing Obama's tweet about the debate, you know, the sort of, well, bad debates happen, but kind of tweet that he did. I did wonder if this was a sort of show of force in some way, like a show of, it actually doesn't matter how the debate goes. It doesn't matter if he's getting slaughtered in the polls. Like, that's not what this is about. What this is about is the plan.
Yeah. And I think that's what matters. I think it's almost more important for them to like to discipline their voters. And I said on the show we recorded yesterday, there was that New York Times headline like Biden in a staring contest with his own voters. And it's like this election is now a contest between Biden and his own voters. And I think he's more interested in winning that than defeating the Republicans or Donald Trump and, you know, saving American democracy. I mean, it's pretty, I mean, I know Reagan was like completely out to lunch for his second term, but like there was just less, I don't know, like people just didn't see it all the time the way they're doing now.
Quite apart from all the news that's happening, one of the things that I've found most entertaining the past 5 or 6 days has been like the different kinds of cope among, like, I mean, there's Democratic partisans who actually seem to have bought the idea that Biden was fine, like just normal, like well-adjusted people that vote for the Democrats. But like the ones who are like the really hardcore, like blue MAGA types, you know, there was like the first stage of this was the New York Times editorial board came out with that op-ed saying Biden should step aside. And then there was like the line that, well, actually the New York Times editorial board is basically a Republican mouthpiece.
That's the one that I think is the most incredible, is like that they're all turning on like the New York Times and MSNBC and CNN, who are all desperately trying to drag the Democrats across the finish line here. And even in that debate, it was set up for Biden to fucking to romp on Trump because they want the Democrats to win. They take seriously the idea. And like, you know, as do I, that like another 4 years of the Republicans, like, look, that this has been the case for the Republican Party for years now. This is a restatement of what the Republican Party wants to do, which is to have an executive that can overrule democracy, and then like just like, yeah, like basically get rid of what few strands remain connecting America to even the idea of democracy. So I think they want to prevent that from happening. So that's why they are saying, hey, it's time. Joe Biden has to step aside. And the people, yeah, the blue MAGA people have now all just decided that the media is against them and has always been against them.
I woke up this morning and fired up my laptop to George Takei feuding with Jon Favreau. Okay. Like Mueller, she wrote, has issued a fatwa in response to the heresies of Bill Kristol and David Corn. Like I have never seen anything like this. And it's like very funny that, I mean, you also have the line that like, have you guys seen those things where it's like, I mean, it's like liberal QAnon shit where it's like, well, CNN actually rigged the mics to make Biden sound bad. There was that woman, Heather Cox Richardson, that had the take about how Trump was using some like rhetorical sorcerer's technique to confuse Biden. This is a worrying situation, but I would be lying if I said I was not enjoying it on some level.
I mean, yeah, like I can't help but, you know, enjoy the schadenfreude here, but, you know, especially someone who said that this guy is senile for the last 4 years or so. So, and by the way, another thing about Obama in his statement where it's just like, bad debates happen, folks, go to joebiden.com. I mean, like contrast his intervention in the 2020 primary to right now. And like, is this a guy that really cares about the Democrats winning? No, they care about the right Democrat winning. They care about their people being in there. And like you said, this is a show of force over their own electorate that I think is, because I think the number one thing you have to understand about the Democratic Party is that they can never allow a precedent to be set where voters expect or demand something from them and they do it. That's the one thing that like, that's the one thing that they cannot allow to happen ever. So the fact that over half of the Democratic Party voters say Biden's too old, they don't even hate Biden. They say he's a good guy. He saved us from Trump. He beat an incumbent president. He did his job, but like it's time for him to step aside. We want a different someone else to represent the party. We just don't think he's capable of beating Trump, and we just think he's too old. Like they have to be defeated now because that's an ask. That's an expectation. And that expectation, that precedent just cannot be set.
You know, Will, as a content warrior, you know, as a political podcaster, we're all old enough to remember Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn. I'm just curious, in your line of work, how have you sort of negotiated the dramatic receding of possibility over the last few years? Like, what do you draw from, given, you know, certain of those defeats?
Well, I started a movie podcast. That's how I'm dealing with it.
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, it does seem like the horizon of like a decent future or the ship of state being righted seems to be, you know, we seem to be past that point right now. And I think America, we really are the Pequod right now. And we are, you know, it's just Ahab is at the till And there's really no stopping it at this point. So yeah, I started a movie podcast. I'm just because I want to talk about something other than politics, because there's not a lot to. I mean, up until recently, I mean, we'll see where where this goes. But there's just not a lot to talk about. I mean, I tried. I gave it my best. That's what I have to say.
Well, fair enough. I was hoping for a happier answer than that, but whatever.
Well, I guess that's probably the longest cold open we've ever done. I guess we should officially introduce our guest if you haven't figured out already, folks. It's Will. It's Will from Chapo. And because there are two Wills here, I propose that co-host Will be Sloan for the remainder of the discussion.
Happy to sit in the back seat. It's totally fine.
Thank you so much for joining us again. We're really excited for to talk to you about not only Aaron Sorkin's best show, but like possibly, as we've discovered in the last few weeks, possibly just the best show ever written or filmed. As a way into today's episode, could you tell us a bit about your relationship to Aaron Sorkin? Like, did you watch this show during its original run? I know you guys did like a number of episodes. You did one on this show. I don't remember. I must have listened to it at the time. I don't remember what your take on it was, but presumably like us, you think it's like the best show ever made?
It's pretty great. I mean, my relationship with Aaron Sorkin is, you know, defined by like sort of the Chapo series that we've done on, I think, like pretty much every one of his major TV shows, which are always a delight to talk about. I want to thank you for inviting me on this show, because I haven't had the opportunity to think about or watch Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip since I did an episode about it, like probably 5 years ago.
It's all we've been thinking about lately. Holy shit.
And it was actually like before you guys asked me to come on the show, this was like, I don't know, like 2 weeks ago or something. Just periodically people will post clips from Aaron Sorkin bangers, like for instance the newsroom clip where he tells the pilots about the death of Osama bin Laden. That's an all-timer, but I really don't think that holds a candle to the out of context clip from Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip where Nate Cordry is showing his family around the studio and like his dad is some like, you know, grumpy old-time guy, and he goes, "Oh, this is very nice, son, where you do all your skits." And Nate Cordry like indignantly is like, "Skits, dad? Skits are when the jocks dress up as cheerleaders at homecoming. What's performed here is our sketches by some of the finest comic actors of the world. This is the Versailles of American comedy." And then his dad's like, "Sorry, I can't care about your gay-ass TV show. Your brother's in Afghanistan."
You know, it's funny you should bring that up, because we're very deep into the show right now. And I think we've been finding that this show that began as politics and comedy, and we need comedy to speak truth to power, and SNL has become lax, and we need to stand up to the fundamentalists and save America with comedy. I would say that episode with the military father was kind of the culmination of that. And each week it's drifted further and further away from that mandate. It never topped that moment. And now we're basically coming into the show in this episode where it's just become a workplace soap opera.
I mean, what I like about Studio 60 is that like you get that Aaron Sorkin feel from it, which is the kind of schmaltzy self-importance. But like, unlike a show about the White House, for instance, this is a show about SNL. But like he elevates it to like the same Olympian heights of cultural, social importance. And, you know, like on this episode, we can get into it at the end of it. But I think at the end of it, the scene that really sums up Sorkin and Studio 60 is at the end of the episode where Timothy Busfeld is talking to Allison Janney, playing herself. And by the way, I think it's hilarious that in Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip exists in a universe where both the West Wing and yes, SNL both exist. Because, like, yes, why does America have two of the same show?
Mad TV.
Mad TV.
And like Bradley Whitford, this episode is a weird one because like Bradley Whitford, Amanda Peet, and Matthew Perry are not in it, but Matthew Perry and Bradley Whitford are both on the West Wing. So like, what do they see when they watch the West Wing? Like, I mean, the fact that like in The Sopranos, the guys are always talking about Goodfellas. What does Christopher see on the screen in the scene where Spider gets shot? It reminds me of that. It's like the streams of reality getting crossed with one another.
When Bradley Whitford's character on Studio 60 in the Sunset Strip watches The West Wing, because of course it's probably his favorite show, yeah, it's like the Jake Gyllenhaal movie Enemy. He just sees his someone who looks identical to him out there, except he's not disturbed by it. He's just like, oh, that seems to make sense. It's my identical twin on another TV show.
Can I ask, just to have all the cards on the table, were you ever an unironic West Wing fan?
I mean, yeah, like when I was a kid, it was like I watched it with my family, and it was like family TV hour to watch The West Wing. And this was like, you know, during the Clinton administration, way back when I was like, I was like, Bill Clinton, yeah, he's a good president. Or the Democrats, like they're a good political party. They represent my interests and beliefs. So back then, and look, like Sorkin, like for all of his goofiness and corniness, like, I mean, he does know how to write a TV show. And like The West Wing is an entertaining show. But like the further iterations of Sorkin, whether it's like Sports Night or now Studio 60 and then The Newsroom. Like I said, like when he was doing it about The West Wing, about the White House, about a guy in charge of the world, for all its goofiness and like sort of pretentiousness, it just fit the mold a little bit easier than when he's doing the same thing about fucking SNL or SportsCenter. He invests like the thing he's into or the thing he's watching on TV, like The Newsroom. He's like, what if Keith Olbermann, what if someone really like Keith Olbermann off the leash, you know? And like, that was The Newsroom. And the way he just continues to invest importance, yeah, like in something like SportsCenter or Saturday Night Live, is it's just, you see the treads have worn off the tires, like with each successive Aaron Sorkin show. And they get more and more ridiculous. But yeah, no, I was going to say, like, I think the moment that really sums it up is at the end when Timothy Busfeld is like talking in the earpiece of Allison Janney after like a disastrous live episode of television. He's like, still beats digging ditches for a living. And tell me you didn't have the funnest time of your life, you know? And it's just like, at the end of the day, it's show business, baby. And there's nothing better than that. And there's nothing, also nothing more important than show business.
Yeah, that's right. There's nothing more important than, you know, the sketches that we get in the recap for this episode. It's all your favorites, folks. It's Immaculate My Ass, Hookers at the Pole, The Nicolas Cage Show, Dolphin Girl, Militant Fruit of the Loom, Peripheral Vision Man has been disappeared. That's off. The guys, like those writers that got fired earlier, they left the show. They've taken that somewhere else.
The recap, though, that opening recap is unreal. Just the walk down memory lane that was. Holy
every fucking time. But just further to what you were saying, Will, as a final piece of table setting before we get into the actual plot of this episode, because, you know, one of the central plot points in this episode, you know, so this is episode 17, The Disaster Show. And in this one, you know, Allison Janney is the guest host of the show as herself, as Will said, and everything goes wrong. You know, there's no cue cards. The props are all fucked up. There's all these different problems. And it's because the prop guys have
unions.
That's right. They have walked out in solidarity because of like the Prop Masters Guild or something. Local Prop Masters, Local 44 is going to strike at midnight. Matt Albee has had words with their prop guys. He said something wrong. Those guys have left. Now, one thing we've been finding with this show, Will, is that Aaron Sorkin very rarely seems to write anything. Like his two principal reasons for writing any plot line, it's usually one or the other. It's A, just pure fantasy. So it's like he writes these surrogate characters for himself, and they have to be like the most hilarious, brilliant, sexually charismatic, you know, guys of all time. So there's like, you know, just pure fantasy. Same with The West Wing. Or then the other thing is he litigates, kind of ecstatically relitigates these very specific grievances that he has. So in this show, right, there's the whole plot line about Amanda Peet's husband did, or her ex-husband has this book that's like been on the bestsellers for weeks, The Confessions of a Network Husband. We found out that there's like a New York Daily News story a listener sent us about Aaron Sorkin appears in a book written by a sex worker called Confessions of a High-Priced Call Girl. And so this is directly lifted from his own life. So
well,
because
I mean, on Studio 60, there's the other episode where Nate Cordray gets arrested in Las Vegas. And that's what that also happened to Aaron Sorkin.
Yes.
And then he made a whole episode about it.
So
I think in this episode, Luke, I had the exact same thought as you, as like, where it's just like the small little, like every touch of like plot in this episode is something that Aaron Sorkin is like angry about, whether it's having too many girlfriends or having like rotten teenagers who live in their parents' basement make prank calls to him. I don't know if that's ever happened to him, but whoever did or did not do that to him is being punished in the universe of Studio 60.
Probably. Every time we do an episode, like every single episode we've done on Studio 60, I think this is our eighth one, we get a flood of listener mail where people do the most like exotic research and they turn up these amazing Sorkin anecdotes. But because there's a union plot on this one, I did like look into what could he possibly be sort of litigating here. And I found this interview he did in 2010. It's actually, or I guess it's not an interview, it was a round table he did with Todd Phillips and also this guy, John Wells, who was the West Coast president of the Writers Guild. You know, the sort of money quote in this is Sorkin says, "I'm a union guy. My grandfather was one of the founders of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, which was not just a powerful union, but an important one. But a union makes sense when people have more power as a group than they do as individuals. I have considerably more power as an individual than I do as a member of that group, and I am forced to be a member of that union in order to work." So Aaron Sorkin hates the Writers Guild because he feels like, as this, you know, as a Promethean genius, he should not have to be like bound by its, you know, rules and
principles. He's being shackled by lazier, not as talented writers.
So shall we get into the plot of the episode? This is an unusual episode because it does not feature an appearance by Matt, played by Matthew Perry, or Danny, played by Bradley Whitford, the sort of dual Aaron Sorkins at the center of the show. They are structuring absences. The show takes place virtually in real time during the filming of what in industry lingo is known as the disaster show. I don't know if that's actual industry lingo, but nevertheless, it's the episode of the show that everything goes wrong during because of a wildcat strike by the Prop Masters Union. The whole Prop Masters Union is about to go on strike, but the union members at Studio 60 have gone on strike just a few hours earlier because of an impolitic remark by Danny, the Bradley Whitford character.
You all know what a wildcat strike is. Yeah, don't know what a wildcat. All right, well, you're about to live through one. Local 44 of the Prop Masters Union. Their contract expires at midnight tonight, but our guys decided to walk out early.
When?
10 minutes ago.
Our prop guys walked out?
They did. I can't hear you if y'all talk at once.
Why?
Okay, I heard that.
Why?
Well, Danny was talking about the contract negotiations, and he got frustrated, and he said something a little impolitic that may have been interpreted the wrong way.
What did he say?
He said, "For the love of God, you're just prop guys. You're easily replaceable."
Oh, why would you do that?
So the episode begins with the cast being told by the director of the show that they will have to get their own props, although there's a lot of politics over who can touch the props or when without crossing a picket line. There will also need to be workarounds for the cue cards because the cue card holders are part of the Prop Masters Union. That's the setup, but there are a number of other subplots as usual. I think you'll agree that the most colorful involves Simon, the D.L. Hughley character, as he's negotiating his messy, lossy love life, which...
Who am I going to take to Hawaii?
Yeah. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I think this strand of him being a womanizer has only started to coalesce in the last couple episodes. I don't remember that being so present on the show early on.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's just another character that's like, you know, just one fractal reflection of the prism that is Aaron Sorkin. Danny is the one who like used to be in a relationship with the Sarah Paulson character, who's like, she's a Christian in the
I hate to publicly own you, but that was Matt.
Matt
in a relationship.
Oh, so Matthew Perry's character, not Bradley
That's
Whitford's
right.
character. Like I said, I haven't watched the show in like 6 years.
Bradley Whitford is pursuing Amanda Peet, the head of programming at the network. And collectively, they're a sort of alpha and beta of Aaron Sorkin's personality.
We'll just say Aaron Sorkin. Aaron Sorkin, because he was in a relationship with, I think, Kristen Chenoweth, who spoke about being a Christian in the entertainment industry. And this is a plot line in Studio 60 as well, if I remember.
But, I mean, there was one moment on this episode, more than any other, that kind of leapt out at me, which is the D.L. Hughley character, who, up until this episode, I hadn't really registered as being an avatar for Aaron Sorkin. But there's a moment where, you know, he's trying to, you know, negotiate a new romance, and she asks him, are the rumors about you true? You know, Mariah Carey, Beyonce.
You don't think I've heard all the stories about you?
They're not true.
Mariah Carey.
That was true.
Beyonce.
That was true.
Okay.
Those stories are about me and somebody else, not you. Look, if you don't want to go to Hawaii, that's fine.
And that was, I think, the moment when this character really starts to... I don't think Aaron Sorkin himself has been in relationships with Mariah Carey and Beyonce, but he thinks of himself as the sort of person who would have those kind of high-profile, like, famous ex-girlfriends.
He wants you to fill in your head the white people version of who Beyonce and Mariah Carey would be in his universe. Right.
This is by far the funniest thing in this episode to me, and I feel like it is the most Sorkin-y thing in an episode that is kind of like, I mean, it's unusual. I guess he has done, like, there's the episode of The West Wing that you might remember well, where Allison Janney, like, just goes home to her dad who has dementia and then complains that equity standards in the teachers union is have, like, less talented black women, as she puts it, have risen above him, and that's why he has dementia. But, like, every so often he does these episodes that are, like, outside of the timeline, you know, like there's the Isaac and Ishmael one famously. Here he's trying to do a bit of an, I don't know, upstairs, downstairs, or like, this is like the shitty version of TNG's Lower Decks or something. Like,
right.
But like the really Sorkin-y thing that he does here is, I don't know if D.L. Hughley is meant to exactly be like a surrogate for Sorkin himself in the way that like Matt or Danny is. But like, nonetheless, this whole plot line where there's like multiple beautiful women that we meet in this episode who he's dated, who like might get on a plane with him and go to Hawaii the next day, even if they've only been on one date. It's established, Sloan, as you were saying, that he has dated Mariah Carey. He's dated Beyonce. It's also, like, I've been keeping a tally of this. It's been established that Matt Albee, Matthew Perry's character, has dated Fiona Apple, Rachel McAdams, and Mina Suvari. And this is why Aaron Sorkin is Aaron Sorkin, because he cannot help himself. He has to do the most maximalist version of everything. It can't just be that Simon, the D.L. Hughley character, dates attractive women. He has to have dated the most attractive and famous women in the world. It's like in The West Wing, there's the episode where like the president and Sam or something are playing chess, and he has to add in the touch that like the chess set was owned by like a famous Mughal emperor, or the knives that President Bartlett gives to Charlie were owned by Paul Revere. Like, he has to dial up everything to 11 all the time. And yeah, on this show, it's also established, just further to the tally, that Bruce Springsteen, Steven Spielberg, and Tom Hanks are all friends with Matthew Perry and all visit the set regularly.
I know it's a bit of a, it goes without saying to accuse Aaron Sorkin of sexism, but I'm going to say it anyway. I mean, the use of Mariah Carey and Beyonce or Rachel McAdams or whoever, just, you know, actual living human women just sort of casually thrown into the dialogue as notches on these characters' bedposts.
Yeah, fucker.
It's sick, folks. It's sick.
But I mean, okay, so that's basically, that's all there is to the D.L. Hughley plot, really. I mean, there's like, it's played for laughs. Like,
One more thing on Sorkin's misogyny here. All of like his female characters are basically like, they're high school girls. Like, they are teenagers. Like, the mentality of the women he writes are like, even if they have high powered professional jobs, they're still like teenage girls. And you see this in the girlfriends D.L. Hughley has, who, like, you know, the plot line is that he's only dated these women for like a couple months before moving on. They're, you know, casual, you know, not exactly serious relationships. And then like, he's like, oh, my girlfriend just broke up with me. And then he's like, okay, I'll ask another woman to go to Hawaii. And then the original woman who broke up with him is like, oh, I was wrong. I'd like still like to go to Hawaii. And then like, it all blows up. But like, both of the women that like slap D.L. Hughley at multiple points are just sort of like, you can't ask someone out to the school dance after you broke up with you. It's like, these women are supposed to be like in their 30s or whatever, and they're talking about relationships like they're in fucking high school. They're just like, you know, you can't just ask another girl out after I break up with you. You have to give me at least like, you know, a couple months before you ask someone else out on a date, you know. And it's just sort of like, who is like this in their 30s? Like, these are adult women, these are adult people. And yeah, just like, I mean, I know it's played for laughs or whatever, but it just didn't seem, it's just like the reactions of D.L. Hughley's girlfriends in this seem to me like the behavior of someone in high school, not like,
I mean, an adult. It is played for laughs, but at the same time, like, the show genuinely does want you to believe that the Matthew Perry character has dated Rachel McAdams or that D.L. Hughley has dated Mariah Carey. So it played for laughs, but also it's a certain asserting that as like something that you're supposed to believe, you know?
Well, to his misogyny, something that we've been following over the course of this series is, she's not in this episode, but the Amanda Peet character begins, you know, she's head of programming or whatever for the network, and she begins as this hyper-competent, extremely like buttoned up, extremely professional woman. And then as she becomes more and more the object of affection for the Bradley Whitford character, there's this process that's taking place of, she has to be humbled just a little bit more in every episode. She has to become just a little bit clumsier, a little less competent, a little bit more awkward, basically so that the show can put her in her rightful place as sub to Bradley Whitford. And that's, I think, a common Sorkin trope, isn't it?
Yeah, he's the white Tyler Perry. You know, these professional females must be brought to heel and humbled in some way before they can get with it, before they can be with a good man like Aaron Sorkin.
Well, further to what you were just saying, well, I mean, that's a good segue into one of the other sort of minor plots in this episode. God, it's ridiculous how much he packs into. This is the shortest episode of this show. I think it's 35 minutes, and there are at least three plot lines. There's also this further recriminations from Luke's breakup with Harry. So they've fallen out on the set of the Brian Jones biopic that she's gonna star in.
He's a master of structure. I mean, I respect that about him. It's incredible all the plates that he keeps spinning.
But so, I mean, what do you even say about this? There's, yeah, these like very high school conversations that Harry, played by Sarah Paulson, has with Jeannie in the green room or whatever, in the dressing room, where Jeannie's told you can go out with Matt. It's, oh, by the way, been established that Matt has just slept with Jeannie like multiple times. He just sleeps with Jeannie whenever he wants, and they don't act, you know, they don't actually date.
Hey, remember what I said before? Don't worry about it.
Remember what I said before?
When? You know, about the thing. And I said one thing, and then I went back and said, no, another thing.
Oh, when you said I could go out with Matt.
Jeannie. You're going out with Matt?
No, I'm not allowed to. You are. You changed your mind.
Yes, so let's drop it now.
Is it okay for them to go out with Matt, or just...
It's okay for anybody to go out with Matt.
If I go out with somebody, does it have to be Matt?
Anybody can go out with anybody.
And then, yeah, there's just some bullshit with the co-workers frustrated that Harry and Matt aren't together. And I mean, frankly, at this point, so am I, because how long is he going to fucking string out this, like, will they or won't they bullshit? This has been, like, one of the central plots in the show from the very beginning, and all it ever yields is, like, them arguing about, like, the geological age of the Earth. There's nothing. Yeah. It's nothing.
I mean, yeah, he loves, like, I mean, I think I read Sorkin's favorite movie is His Girl Friday. And you can tell, like, sure, the influence on his writing. I think the thing that he misses in His Girl Friday is that the Rosalind Russell character is, like, actually really good at her job and very much the equal of Cary Grant. And he tries to get that same dynamic in the male-female relationships in his show, but he can't help but make the women, like, fucking suckers and, like, annoying brats over and over again.
Well, there are certain things he's very technically good at, obviously, but he doesn't have a lot of empathy. He doesn't have a lot of curiosity. So the Sarah Paulson character, her one defining trait on this show is that she's a Christian. And it never gets beneath Christianity as just a mere cultural signifier. Whenever Christianity comes up, it's only mentioned in the context of the culture wars or gay marriage. There's never any sort of consideration of, well, what does Christianity mean in this character's life? What does she get out of it? Does she get, you know, community? Is there anything in Christ's teachings that speak to her better angels? Because he's not curious about that. And you could say something similar about the treatment of the prop masters union on this episode, where, it's funny that this is kind of like, you know, as you said, Luke, an upstairs downstairs thing, where the prop masters union, I mean, it is quite literally just a prop, or it's the MacGuffin. You know,
well, you never see them. This is a show about a show. He's showing you the writer's room. You know, there's Cal, who's like the director. He shows you like the room where they're like deciding what camera to use and stuff. He also shows you the higher ups, like middle management, the suits. The prop masters union in this is referenced but never seen. So it's like upstairs, downstairs without the downstairs. It's like lower decks without the junior officers, which is the whole point. And that is a very interesting occlusion, I think, and a very telling one.
It's interesting because Aaron Sorkin, I think, is capable, or maybe he's not capable. He has some understanding, or he incorporates to some degree class resentment in his work, but it's only you know, class resentment among the upper middle to upper,
the upper middle class to the upper class.
Right. So I'm thinking of in The Social Network, Zuckerberg feels so much resentment against like the meathead, like ivory tower.
When they don't let him into the dining club, they like make him stand in like the coat room or whatever. They're like, yeah, you can't come into the
right.
And then with the Andrew Garfield character, gets accepted into one of the Harvard, like what are they called, dining clubs or
or the goddamn Winkle bosses.
Exactly.
Meathead jocks. But there's also something earlier in this show where Matt and Danny are at some after party and there are these young, like, I don't know, 18, 19 year old, like Tiffany type girls, you know, some like just out of high school. And they don't know what writing is. They don't know what TV is, but they want to be where famous people are. And they immediately ditch Matt and Danny to go hang out with the athletes who are at the after party, you know, baseball players. So he's capable of that kind of class resentment.
I do have actually one other point that I wanted to get in. This is a little bit back in the conversation, but I do think it's interesting that Aaron Sorkin references in a number of places. Like, I've seen him talk about, you know, his like union background and stuff like that. You know, the his grandfather, you know, this role that he apparently had in the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, which was indeed like a very important
union. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. That was his grandfather.
right. But like one of the things we've discovered on this show is that Aaron Sorkin's reference points, like to understand why they're so arbitrary, why there's like certain things he approves of and certain things that he doesn't. What holds them together, the glue that gives them coherence or cohesiveness, is not so much ideology. It's just like whether like he thinks they're vintage or not. So like the episode where they talk about product placement and Aaron Sorkin is like very upset, as are his characters, that like Studio 60 might have to have product placement. They don't want to do ads for these debased things like iPods and shit like that. But then the compromise they come up with, the compromise that we're left with the swelling, you know, music at the end, is that, well, what if we have brands that are part of like the American story? So what if we like have product placement inserted into the sketches?
Like Geritol on Quiz Show.
Literally, it's like Paramount, Coca-Cola, shit like that. And it's like that old school capitalism is fine because in his mind palace, it's associated with like, this is Make America Great Again for like Gen X liberals, literally. And similar, to finish the point, I feel like he's fine with the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, but not the Writers Guild or like Union Stay, because that's in the past.
In the past. That's all in the past. And Aaron Sorkin doesn't know or care about anyone who's a garment worker today, because most of them are in, you know, Southeast Asia. So it's like, that's just not a reality for him. But like when the writers or like prop people that he works with, when they start asserting some sort of a union authority or, you know, negotiating position, then he's like, do we really need a writer's guild? Do we really need a prop union? Like, you know, what's like Danny says, it's like, you're all replaceable. It's like, no shit. That's why they have a union. That's the point of having a union, is so that assholes like you can't just fire them and replace them if they, you know, want a longer lunch break or something. Or like the hot young women at the party who only want to talk to baseball players. These girls probably don't even know who Norman Lear is. Those dumb bitch.
Yeah, they've never read Balzac or Aristophanes or Abbott and Costello, which are like three reference points that he leans on in this show a lot for some reason.
Oh, and I return again. Like, I think it was like, I'm remembering back to the episode that we did about it when I watched it. I'm like, on the first episode of Studio 60, when they bring in, you know, Matt and Danny, I was like the hot shot replacements. They're like, you know, Studio 60 Friday night on the Sunset Strip has gotten stale. It's safe and it's not challenging its audience anymore. We need to get these young, cool, cutting edge writers back in to like challenge the audience. And the way they announce that like the ship of this Saturday Night Live show is being steered in a new direction is that their opening sketch is a fucking riff on Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh yeah,
that
famous episode with the military father climaxes with Nate Corddry giving him a record that I think was recorded at Studio 60 all those years ago, and it's Who's On First by Abbott and Costello. You know, and that's like the one piece of comedy history that Aaron Sorkin names by name. And in the context of this show about we need comedy that speaks truth to power, we need comedy that is daring and edgy, like, really, who's on first? Not your reference point isn't, I don't know, even Lenny Bruce.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, the main plot line on this episode, which I guess we've sort of talked about because of the prop master plot, is basically Allison Janney trying and failing to guest host the show. It's like she doesn't have cue cards. When Sarah Paulson is doing the incredible Nancy Grace sketch, she spits something from her coffee mug because apparently, I don't know, the union thugs like put something in it or something before they walked off. Allison Janney is doing the opening monologue. She's confusing, you know, whether she's in New York or LA, whether she's on SNL or Studio 60. One thing I did like about this plot line, though, is that because it's all like we actually haven't seen an episode of Studio 60 within Studio 60 for like several episodes now. But because this one is all about a show that's disastrous, we do actually get to see more of the sketches. And I did like that about it. So yeah, we get the Nancy Grace sketch, and then possibly my favorite Studio 60 sketch ever, which appears to be, the premise of which appears to be, what if James Bond was gay? Because
yeah, gay James Bond.
She and Nate Cordray, like, we see a bunch of sketches and there's some like bullshit like 30s gangster thing they're doing, doesn't really go anywhere. But then Nate Cordray delivers this line where she says, "Mr. Bond, I hope you like your martinis strong," and he says, "Like my men," and that's all we get to see. But
good stuff. So, Will, I'm gonna ask a really stupid question now, because this show is all about the importance of comedy in discourse. It's all about the role that comedy can play in speaking truth to power, etc. You know, you're a content warrior. You've dealt in humor. What is your perspective? Does comedy have a role to play? And if so, what role is it?
I don't think comedy has a role to play in anything cliched like speaking truth to power. I don't think entertainment moves the needle in politics, really. I mean, I think it's fool's gold. It's been like a theme we've returned to over and over again on Choppa, where it's like liberals have all the cultural power in America, but like increasingly less and less political power. And I think it's just like a chimera to believe that if we only get people to, like, you know, watch some righteous truth saying that make you laugh, but also make you think, that like this is some sort of skeleton key that unlocks what are essentially problems of power and politics, and not like changing people's minds. That being said, I mean, I think humor is, like, you know, it's a sword and a shield to wield against the world, but on an individual level, not an elective level of collective political authority or assertion of like power or prerogatives of like the people or, you know, constituent groups made up within it. I think for me, it's a personal thing about how I understand and deal with a world that is out of my control and that I seemingly have no real influence or authority or power over. But that being said, I mean, I think that, like, if you can articulate a point of view, or like an ideological or a political point of view, in a way that isn't not like in the guise of humor, where you're like consciously, stealthily, sneak in political ideas into something funny, because I think that always like lands flat. But I think if comedy or humor is just your natural like inclination to like understanding and dealing with the world, and mostly dealing with all the horrible things in the world, then like I think whatever point you're trying to get across, it goes across much smoother. Or you can, if not convince people, you can just sort of, I don't know, like it seems more authentic. Like in almost anything, like if you can make someone laugh, then I think you've like already got past all of their defenses of what would otherwise, like, you know, barriers or sort of stumbling blocks that would usually, if you were just trying to like make a point directly, or like I said, do this kind of thing where you're trying to smuggle a political idea in the guise of a joke or satire, which usually doesn't work, or it announces itself. It's a little too obvious. I just think that's kind of a rambling answer, but I just think for me personally, I think humor is just on an individual level is the way I understand the world, or it's the way I can deal with the world or talk about it, is, you know, trying to make a joke out of it, or like the things that are the funniest in life are the things that are the most tragic and fucked up.
Thank you. That is a more thoughtful answer than I deserved.
It was a bad show. Can you hear me?
Yeah, thank you very much.
I mean, classic can be bad, but it still beats digging a hole for a living, right? Tell me you still didn't have the time of your life tonight.
Thank you.
I mean, we've sort of exhausted. I mean, there's the stupid bomb threat plot on this episode where it seems like it's about a Muhammad sketch, and then it turns out it's just two. You alluded to this already. Well, it's just it's these two urchins or whatever. Like, what is the point of that plot?
The point of that plot. I mean, again, like that. It was like the most minor plot in an episode that are all just minor plot points. Is that like the FBI is called in and there's like a bomb sniffing dog? It's just one of the many disasters that happened on this disastrous live episode. But they're like, oh, it's because of our Muhammad, the thin-skinned prophet sketch. And I'm like, in what universe would they even consider doing that? Like on Studio 60. I mean, like, what were they expecting to happen? Like, here's our sketch where we visually depict the prophet Muhammad. But and then like it all just like the denouement is that it's just two rotten teenagers, and like they have to make the point that they live in their parents' basement. And that to me was like the worst bit of Sorkin writing, because it's just such a cliche. And like it just made me think, like, the week that they were writing that episode, did someone prank call Aaron Sorkin? Like, that's all I can think of. And then like as they're being led away by the FBI, the Steven Weber character is like, good luck getting a job ever now that you've ruined your life by
he says you're not gonna fly in a plane for a while, go to college or get a job, which is there's three things. The worst thing that can happen to someone, you're not going to get to go to college, you know? So yeah, that's kind of the episode. One of the thinnest episodes of a very thin show, although, you know, as you've all just heard, fertile ground for discussion. I do have, maybe just to close this out here, one kind of, I don't know, higher order question that I think has implications both in the current moment, but also just in any evaluation of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. I mean, just further to the discussion we were having a few moments ago about the importance of culture and entertainment to liberals, it makes me realize I've never really given that much thought to the question of when did this prioritization of those things start for liberals? Like, when does culture begin to become so central to them? I mean, just last week, you know, I was reading from an article, this was before the debate, actually. There was an article, I think, in the Washington Times, where it was some columnist basically saying, like, the way for Biden to win re-election is to hire Christopher Nolan to make sort of like epic not even campaign.
He's not
ads,
even
like,
American. What the fuck?
Not even fucking American. But
he should
like,
be doing that for Keir Starmer, not Biden.
Yeah. Yeah. He's probably voting for Starmer. But anyway, yeah, like the proposal was something like hire Christopher Nolan, not even to do campaign ads, but to like do films where like the themes of democracy are like inserted in a way that's like, I don't know, engaging an electorate that's turned off and doesn't understand what's at stake. I mean, this is just one recent example amid a trillion dumb things like this. But I don't know, Will, when in your view did this start? Because I don't think we're during like the fucking Jimmy Carter era or like Johnson, Kennedy, FDR. Like, was this shit so important to liberal America? It seems like it's a newer phenomenon to me.
I mean, I think this is a phenomenon that has been exponentially magnified and intensified by the election of Donald Trump in 2016, of that like brain-breaking paradigm shift of a TV character who like everyone assumed this was impossible becoming president. I think a lot of people, like, when confronted with the question of how could this happen, didn't look at the candidate that was run or just the general, like the fact that Hillary Clinton ran for the White House without articulating a single positive vision of like what a Democratic presidency or what her presidency would represent to the American people. It goes back to what I said at the beginning about like the Democrats have a coalition that like depends on them not giving anything to the people who vote for them, except for like the donor class of people. Like that's who their real constituency are. And that constituency, they care about what's on television. And I think when they turn on the TV to watch the American politics, the show, they want to see their guy there. And not much else. And they don't really want much change. And I think this is like a knock-on effect of like the turn in the 70s to like both the neoliberal revolution, whatever you want to call it, the financialization of the US economy, the, you know, just sort of cleaving off of like a labor constituency from the Democratic Party as the, you know, the US economy was changed dramatically. I just think it's like it's a knock-on effect of being unable to deal with the consequences of abandoning a political vision or political power entirely in favor of the market and just like and offering people only, we're not the Republicans. So that's why, like, I think politics is not a terrain under which big issues or like the things that matter in people's life are really contested anymore. That's not for the people. That's not for voters. That's for elites. And so like what is for voters, what is for the masses is entertainment. culture, things like that. So that's why liberals, as they fail, and things like the Republicans continue to win elections, or Donald Trump could very well be reelected president, as they fail more and more, I think, like, they retreat from politics and into this world of culture and this idea that, like, if only we could get people to, like, imbibe the correct messages directed by Christopher Nolan to really make people feel how important democracy is, like, that's the issue, and not that they as a political party or that our system of government as a democracy have failed people.
The politics of representation, there'd obviously been an emphasis on that for a long time, but I could be oversimplifying this, but around the time that Donald Trump hosted SNL, or maybe around the time that Jimmy Fallon did the hair thing with Trump, I feel like we started to hear a lot more about platforming and the potential danger of exposing certain messages and like the need to win certain TV shows and culture. So, Luke, to answer your question, obviously there are a million precedents for, you know, from Charlie Chaplin playing Hitler to Borat to, you know, Jon Stewart or anything about like the role of culture in politics. But I seem to think of that as a particular decisive moment as when that became an all-important terrain.
Yeah, it's this idea that like it was the platforming of Donald Trump by, and like, look, there's a certain truth to that. Like whoever the producer at NBC who created The Apprentice was, like if you're looking to blame someone for Donald Trump, start with him.
Yeah.
Because it was The Apprentice that like reintroduced Donald Trump to America as a national figure after decades of being a complete punchline, if thought of at all. But like that's what established like a relationship in people's minds again with Donald Trump is like, oh, he's the businessman. He's the business genius. He fires people. And then having Trump host SNL. And like this idea that like, oh, like it was the media's fault because they sort of, I don't know, like they made people too comfortable with him and they should have been more responsible. And like, sure, they probably should have. But like the reason people voted for him, look, him being on television helps a lot. But once again, it's this inability to like confront the reality of politics and political power that they refuse to engage with. So that's why they blame it, like Donald Trump being on SNL is what made him president. And that like, oh, it's dangerous to platform the president. It's like, he already has a fucking platform. You know, like when he was on SNL, he was running for president. You know what I mean? Like that's a platform that's there regardless of whether you have him on SNL or not. But like, yeah, I just think it's like, Brian Quimby said a long time ago that for liberals, comedians are like the troops. I don't know. That's always struck me as being very, very on point.
And that, if anything, if there's one thesis to Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, it is that, Abbott and Costello are the troops, like Studio 60 are the troops, like Nate Corddry literally has a brother in Afghanistan. And the show's message is like, as you
what
said,
they do well, is like, justice.
It's a war on two fronts. Yeah,
that's right. Okay, I mean, that is probably a good place to leave things. Will Menaker, thank you so much for joining us for this discussion of The Disaster Show. An absolute pleasure.
Pleasure is all mine. Thanks, guys.
Make them laugh, make them laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My dad said be an actor, my son. But be a comical one. They'll be standing in lines for those old honky-tonk monkey shines. Or you could study Shakespeare and be quite elite. And you could charm the critics and have nothing to eat. Just slip on a banana peel, the world's at your feet. Make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh.